I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Healthcare is back on top of President Trump's batting order again, ahead of what he calls tax reform. So what's new? What's possible? In the new Republican Washington that hates the last president's extension of subsidized insurance to the needy, Obamacare it's called. But they couldn't agree last month to even to vote on an alternative. The subject is human well-being, but also the biggest industry in this country, $3 trillion worth. It's also the political riddle that got set aside in Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal version of the welfare state, left out back in the 1930s with anti-lynching laws and racial justice in the Jim Crow South. Ever and always, healthcare resurfaces as a conflict of ideals, the common good up against individual choice.
We are behind every country pretty nearly in Europe in this matter of medical care for our citizens.
One of the traditional methods of imposing statism or socialism on a people has been by way of medicine. Most people are a little reluctant to oppose anything that suggests medical care for people who possibly can't afford it.
And we have now just enshrined, as soon as I sign this bill, the core principle that everybody should have some basic security when it comes to their health care.
I've been saying for the last year and a half that the best thing we can do, politically speaking, is let Obamacare explode. It is exploding right now.
We're looking at several faces of the healthcare impasse this hour, starting with one doctor's analysis that could make you sick. Our guest, Elizabeth Rosenthal, wrote the book that really barges in on the official debate. She says we've lost the best of our medical system while we were arguing about it. The book is called An American Sickness by a Harvard medical doctor who covered her changing profession in the New York Times. Libby Rosenthal, if I may, you write that a complex treasure of caring and science is driven now in the best medical capitals like our very own town of Boston by financial and not medical incentives. It's been driven off the road. In short, Explain.
Well, when I was covering the lead up to the Affordable Care Act, I repeated this phrase that's become the mantra of innovation, that we're looking for patient-centered, evidence-based care. And I repeated that hundreds of times, as all of the health policy people have done. And then when I was starting to research the book, I thought, wait, what other kind of medical care could there be? I mean, isn't that the definition of medicine? And I realized in researching this book that so much of what we do now is defined by the finance behind it and the fact that much of our medical system is for-profit or profit-making. And that's not to say that a doctor, like, operates on you because he wants to send his kid to, you know, a high-priced college next year. But those financial incentives kind of insidiously worked into their way into our system.
Drug companies, equipment, doctor collectives, all manner of inventions to find the dollars. An example of one that offends you. I gotta say, I read this. This should be an incendiary book if I read it right. It made me furious on every page.
Well, the reason I wrote it is because I was furious and I felt I needed to get it out. You know, I was a project reporter at the New York Times covering healthcare costs. And then the project was done. It was called Paying Till It Hurts. And they said, well, maybe we'll write about infrastructure now. And I was like, no, I'm not done. And partly because I'd heard so many terrible stories that I felt I needed to respond to, and hence the book. So, there are so many different examples. I mean, there's one in the book of a medicine called Duexis, which is a combination of two over-the-counter medicines. Mm. It's approved by the FDA. And it costs hundreds and hundreds of dollars a month. Now, when your doctor is detailed by the drug company salesman, the salesman doesn't say, you know how expensive this is. He doesn't have to say that. He says, I've got this great new drug, and it treats the, you know, your headache and your heartburn and all those different things. And guess what? The patient only discovers, as I found out about this drug, when they go to the pharmacy and the pharmacist says, oh, it's not covered and it's $800. And then it's like, whoa, what's that about? And I think that kind of financially driven medicine, that pill, how do I say this?
Go Go for it.
It's not an advance. You know, it's not healthy. What, it's kind of a little more convenient, I guess, because they're both in one, but it's kind of like a scam. You know, it's like snake oil.
You wrote about pills that may or may not give you another 100 days of attenuated life at the very end, cancer drugs. And then I opened up the New Yorker magazine, and there was one about a guy who thought he might be dead, and suddenly he's driving his kids to school a few more times. Followed, two-page ad, followed by 2 pages of fine print,
yeah,
qualifying and expressing the reservations that nobody will read, especially when they think there's a hope,
right,
involved. But let me come to the retrospective on Obamacare. I thought you could have subtitled your book something to the effect that we're talking about evils in our medical system that Obamacare didn't want to see, much less touch, to wit, money, starting with insurance companies.
Yeah, I think politically the Obama administration felt like it had to get buy-in from insurers, from hospitals, from doctors' organizations in order to get this bill passed. Now, why did they need buy-in? It's because a lot of Congress is heavily lobbied by those groups and heavily dependent on them for campaign donations.
Buy-in means surrender. I mean, that's a political ego looking for a brand and giving away the store. I mean, I keep waiting for the James Carville who will tell the politicians, even the ones they're working for, it's the money, stupid. That's the problem. And if you duck it, there's no solution.
Well, Princeton economist Uwe Reinhardt has been saying that to no end for 25 years,
I think.
He's
a good guy, I hope.
He's a great guy. He's German originally, so I think he knows that there is another possibility for a healthcare system. But I think, you know, in terms of buy-in, you know, the reality of our political system, particularly after Citizens United, is that our politicians are responding to the people who have interests in the medical system as more than they're responding to patients. And that's sad because, look, when these things are negotiated, who's at the table? The insurers, the hospitals. There's no one representing the patients, really. I mean, not you and me. I hope this book will do that, and that's why I wrote it.
Let me just say, the best line in your book is a famous answer that I had never heard before. It was from Jonas Salk talking to Edward R. Murrow on CBS television in the 1950s. Salk was a world hero by then for conquering polio. Ed Murrow asked him who owned the patent on his new polio vaccine. And Dr. Salk replied, well, the people, I would say. There is no patent. And then he said, could you patent the sun?
Yeah.
I mean, in this neighborhood, we're all fascinated by the war between MIT and Berkeley, Broad Institute.
I was just going to say that.
And,
yep,
you know, over who's going to patent these gene splicing techniques,
the CRISPR technique,
et cetera. And the Broad Institute won the last round.
These are hundreds
of millions of investor dollars, not to mention lawyers, around a medical mystery. How can this be?
Well, and you know, I mentioned that this morning, that it shocks me that the big news around this CRISPR technology is not what it will do for patients, but who owned for patents.
Maybe to the human species. We're talking about changing human DNA, maybe for all time.
Yeah, and some of that is not Salk being so noble. It's that our notion of what's patentable has changed so much since medicine has become commercialized, right? If medicines weren't this really, really, really profitable thing, and treatments weren't really, really profitable, people wouldn't care so much who owned the patent to them. But now it's considered, you know, the first thing in a university's sights is not really what this will do for patients, but how much money am I going to make for this? This may underwrite some building or a new program.
There are investors behind them, speculators. I want to ask you who let them in, but I also just want to say on every page of your book, there's an open scandal. Among them, doctors, say radiologists, who can look at scans from anywhere, and they have extenders in, you know, you name it, 6, 8, 10 cities around the country, and they can charge the patient as if they were there, as if they were everywhere.
It reminded me of a famous case in Boston, a very sensitive one. A great orthopedic surgeon, Dennis Burke, blew the whistle at Massachusetts General on doctors working two operating rooms at the same time, concurrent surgeries.
Right.
He complained inside, finally went outside, and the great name that he is in MGH surgery was fired for talking about what's clearly dirty linen. How can this be happening in what we regard as, you know, semi-sacred institutions around here with pride?
Yeah, I mean, you see this kind of escalation in all segments of medicine. You know, first, maybe dermatologists will have extenders, so they'll have two or three, and they lobby heavily to be allowed to bill as if they're in the room, right? This is where the lobbying comes in. First pass, you say, wait, you look at your bill, I never saw that doctor, right? And you realize it was an extender. Now, they had to lobby hard to be allowed to bill for those extenders. So the dermatologists do it, the radiologists do it. Next thing you know, the orthopedists are thinking, wow, you know, if dermatologists can be in eight places at once for billing, maybe we can be in two. So they do this double billing in the OR. The last step of that is, which is in the book, is the cardiac surgeons recently did a study showing that it was fine for patients if cardiac surgeons were running two rooms at once. Now, you know, if you're applying the logic of business efficiency, yeah, maybe that's more efficient. But if you're applying the rules of what I want for my heart surgery, I don't want that.
Well, if you're applying the laws of common sense, you're reminding me that my mother discovered that her gynecologist, or her obstetrician, was on the golf course the afternoon that my youngest brother was born, and she's, you're not going to get paid, buddy. I think it was $100, but that was the end of it.
Right, right. Well, you know, the other title for the book was You Don't Get What You Pay For.
We're talking about medicine invaded, really, maybe taken over forever by big business and a completely different set of rules. Coming up, the entrepreneur Jonathan Bush wants to tell you what digitized markets can do for healthcare. It sounds something like the Uber effect on taxicabs. This is Open Source. Speaking of Obamacare, which President Trump says is exploding. Sometimes he says it's imploding. The decorated health economist at MIT, Jonathan Gruber, says, in fact, it's doing almost exactly what it was designed to do. And John Gruber was a principal designer of universal mandated insurance, first the Massachusetts Republican version known as RomneyCare, and then Obamacare. He spoke with us this week.
I think that the law is doing quite well. I mean, if you look at Obamacare, there are really three fundamental goals. One was to cover the uninsured. 20 million uninsured have gained insurance. And moreover, if states had done their part and expanded Medicaid programs, as would have been in their voters' interests, we would have had a reduction in the uninsured of more like 25 to 27 million people. Mm. That's point one. Point two is we've stabilized a broken non-group insurance market. You know, many of your listeners, like myself, have employer-sponsored insurance. And we don't realize how awful it was before January 1, 2014, if you didn't have employer-sponsored insurance and had to try to go and buy insurance on your own. You could be denied for a pre-existing condition. You could be charged a fortune just because they didn't like the cut of your jib, or more relevantly, because you were sick.
Mm-hmm.
That ended, and we created new markets, which have actually functioned quite well. The premiums in 2017 in these markets, the much maligned markets, are actually exactly where we predicted them to be in 2010. And then finally, the third goal of the law was to control healthcare costs. And we haven't solved the problem, and we'll never solve the problem, but healthcare costs in the US have grown more slowly since Obamacare than at any time in measured US history.
You say it's grown more slowly. They're still way off the charts of first-class world systems.
Actually, if you look at how it's grown over the last 6 or 7 years, it's grown at about a similar rate to the rest of the world, which is what matters. Look, at the end of the day, it's not the level that matters. What matters is getting the growth under control. If we can just have healthcare costs grow at the rate of the economy, we will solve the entire long-run fiscal problem of the U.S. government. It's that easy. So we don't have to spend less. We just have to stop growing so fast.
Speak to the good sort of big government liberals, John, who would love to go Medicare for all right away.
I think there's a lot to recommend it. I think there's some difficult issues they don't recognize. But in some sense, it's all kind of irrelevant because it's politically really just so incredibly difficult. Remember, the reason Medicare is cheaper is because Medicare pays providers less. So Medicare for All means that providers are going to earn a ton less money. They will not let that happen.
There are more patients than professionals in this game. Wouldn't it be good for everybody to get the prices down?
It would absolutely be good for everyone to get the prices down. But the thing to remember, Chris, is if it's going to take my insurance from $5,000 a year to $4,000 a year, but it's going to take my doctor's income from $500,000 to $250,000, he's going to lobby and I'm not.
Shame on us for avoiding fights that we could win, John.
You know what, Chris? There's no evidence we can win it. We've tried healthcare reform every 17 years for the last 100 years, and it's always failed. And the reason that Obamacare finally succeeded is it was much less ambitious in picking those fights. And you know what? Obamacare passed, and nothing else ever did.
That was the MIT health economist, Jonathan Gruber. Adam Gaffney, MD, joins us. He doctors lungs, pulmonary and critical care medicine with the Cambridge Health Alliance. You wrote the detailed lead piece, Adam, just out in the British Medical Bible called Lancet on the inequalities in American medicine. Not much changed by Obamacare so far. Inequalities of access and quality in healthcare, it's still the rule that wealth is the measure of care that people get. It's the first measure. You just heard the good news from John Gruber. But did Obamacare ever really face the price tag issues here?
I think Obamacare did not fix the fundamental problems of our healthcare system, costs being one of them. I mean, I think one misconception we should also keep in mind is that Obamacare was not a universal healthcare system. Professor Gruber mentioned that it achieved the goal of expanding coverage, yet 28 million people remain uninsured in 2016.
A lot of it because of price. Either they look at the copays and the deductibles and they say it's just not worth it.
Well, that's a separate issue. That's underinsurance, which is also a problem. Copayments and deductibles are rising. People are choosing not to get health care because it's simply too expensive to fill a prescription, to go to the doctor. In fact, there's a study that shows that people even avoid the emergency room when they have a high deductible because they're afraid of cost. So Obamacare did not fix those problems in the way that a universal health care system that didn't have those out-of-pocket payments would. And so I think that Obamacare did cover 20 million people, as Professor Gruber mentioned, but let's talk about what it didn't do. All the people left outside, all the people left uncovered, or with insurance that simply was too skimpy to actually cover their health care needs.
When you hear somebody like Jonathan Gruber, a serious man, say you just can't beat the money in this fight, and obviously it's what the Clintons decided and President Obama, what do you respond?
I respond that he's dead wrong. Time and time again, movements of people have overcome powerful corporate interests, powerful state interests. And so I have no doubt that we can do better, that we will do better, and that we just need to put the coalition together that can achieve this long sought after goal.
Let's try the marketplace. Jonathan Bush is the CEO of Athena Health, now based in Watertown, Massachusetts. It's a networking enterprise that dreams of being something like the Amazon of healthcare. The healthcare internet, you said, Jonathan. I've got to say, you're nephew of one President Bush, first cousin of another. Everything I read about Athena makes you a sort of poster child for the rising force of markets. What's good in it for healthcare?
Well, there are like four entire U.S. healthcare systems sitting inside of the money we pay today for the healthcare system. So 50% of all doctors' time in the U.S. today is spent, some health affairs just came out, on administrative tasks that are largely imposed upon them by external sort of regulations around quality, et cetera. 50%. I mean, 10% would be great. 15%, you could live with it. 50%. In addition, if you look inside of the doctor's time, easily 50 by today's standards, with no further innovation of doctors' time, is spent on things that you didn't need to go to 7 years of medical school to do. But as you point out, the only way you can get paid is you run that CPT code through the mill. There is no reward. There is no market in healthcare. A little bit, but not a lot. We could have there be more. And then there's a whole nother one, which is that 38% of all the hospital beds in the United States sit fully funded and empty every night. That doesn't include the many, many, many hospital beds that sit filled with people who do not belong in the hospital, who got surgery in the hospital that should have been in an ambulatory surgery center and a much less asset intensive. So the idea of taking this giant, swollen, disconnected mess and say, let's lock it in and make it a single, you know, because people are trying to make money inside of it, and not-for-profit's the worst of all in terms of trying to make money inside of it. It's important to remember that this for-profit activity that Dr. Rosenbaum was talking about is actually just as practiced by nonprofits as it is by for-profits. That's where I see there's a huge opportunity. What markets do is they suck waste out of systems. And since there is no market in healthcare, there is no waste being sucked out.
I'm still in the spell of Libby Rosenthal's book, and the markets do not bring costs down. They don't suck waste out.
First of all, I love Rosenthal's book. Thank you for writing the book. It's a fantastic book. The only thing that I didn't like about the book is the concept of she talks about the price that markets will bear. That's only true if there's a market. So I think of a market as where there's many buyers, many sellers, freedom to move your money around, and freedom to keep it if you don't spend it. Those conditions are not met almost anywhere in healthcare. There are a few beautiful places.
And Libby writes about that. You write, Libby, about a $25 blood test that you can get on the street, and it's all the same science, or a $1,000 blood test that your doctor will point you to in a fancy hospital. Is that a market? What would market forces
do? It would
do?
Be if you could keep the difference, but you can't.
Well, and I think the other missing element is price transparency, right? Like you have to. I mean, the challenge if you want to try and do healthcare by a market, and you know, I kind of make fun of markets by the rules of the 10 dysfunctional rules of our market, is you need things that I don't know, and maybe Jonathan and I would disagree on this. If you can ever find in healthcare, you need total price transparency, which I think is a good idea no matter what system we go to. I think we absolutely need that. We want to know what people are charging because I don't think a hospital where I got my colonoscopy for $11,000 would charge $11,000 if that was posted in their lobby. Even if people weren't paying, they would rebel. But the second thing you need is choice, right? And I don't have a lot of choice often, and the choice is kind of – lack of choice is hard-baked into our system. My doctor sends me to the lab at his hospital, which PS is probably charging, you know, 100 times as much as Quest.
You write about 100-to-1 differentials in the price of the same automobile in this town and in another town or one hospital and another. How can that be? An example.
Because there's no market.
Because people aren't making the choice and people don't know. It's not transparent. I mean, I had one person who wrote to me about a vitamin D blood test, which P.S. someone had ordered for her a month before at a different doctor. You know, a doctor's probably checking off a list of blood tests and not thinking it was ordered someplace else and has no idea what it's charged. And that doctor was affiliated with Albany Medical Center, so it goes to the lab at Albany Medical Center. No choice anywhere. That was billed at $728, okay? And that lab test...
And the next time it was $4,000, and the time after that it was $19.
Well, and the one she'd had before was $15, you know? And so she said, she wrote to me, she said, what's going on? And I look up the prices, and of course, hospital labs are vastly generally more expensive than outside labs, and Albany Medical Center happens to be the number one charger in New York State for that test. So she's stuck, but...
A nonprofit.
This is a place
Thank
where
God
we absolutely
non-profit.
Agree that.
Who sets the prices at the Cambridge Health Alliance, Adam? And how do you? Who is told coming in that you know, an ear inspection is going to cost you $250 or more?
Well, I have the fortune of not being involved in that side of things. But let me say this. I very much disagree with this notion that more market transparency, more of a market-driven system is going to drive prices down. If that were true, why is it that the United States, which already, relatively speaking, has more of a market-based system than other high-income nations with public systems, why is it that we have such higher healthcare costs? It doesn't make sense. it is true that it's a dysfunctional market, but it doesn't mean that making it more of a pure market will make things better. In fact, it will make things worse, and it will leave people out in the cold.
How so?
Well, first of all, I don't think people want to shop for healthcare. I don't think people want, if certainly not in an emergency, if you get a gunshot wound, you're not really going to be shopping around for the trauma center. But people don't want to balance the quality of an MRI, you know, with its price. They want to take the recommendations, in my experience, of someone they trust, of a provider they trust, and obtain the healthcare that they need without having to worry about how it would affect their livelihood. The reality is that it is difficult enough to be sick. It is difficult enough to deal with illness. You shouldn't have to worry about the price. You should simply be able to obtain the healthcare you need and have that taken off the table.
What's so great about markets, Jonathan?
Well, I think the one thing I disagree with is we don't have a market in the United States, so that's why. Now, if you look inside the United States where markets do exist, so when I started Athena Health in 97, LASIK vision correction was $3,000 an eye, okay? And mammograms were about $800. The equipment to use it to do a mammogram was never under $500,000. Okay, imaging equipment, never under half, usually in the range of $1 million. Today, LASIK vision correction, not in the third-party reimbursed system, yet they have to market and sell and cut price, is $200 an eye. The equipment for which there's a market is down well into the, you can get some for under $10,000, but that same mammogram, if you get it at Partners, is $1,800. If you get it at Cambridge Health Alliance, it's $954. And if you get it at Shields MRI, it's $454. So, you know, there is the fact that there is 80% price variation for a totally commodity thing like a mammogram or an X-ray on the same. They're all using the same piece of equipment, right?
On
the
Medicare,
a digital image.
But in Medicare, there's not the sort of price variation you're talking about. Why? Because it's a fee schedule that is controlled. And that is a way to control healthcare costs. And it's a way that's been used to control healthcare costs an analogous way in other countries.
Let's take a look at
Medicare. Very effectively. And also, I would point out that Medicare is far more efficient from an administrative perspective, with overhead costs around 2%, much higher on private insurers. So the notion that moving to more of a market-driven system is going to drive healthcare costs is not reflected by the evidence or by real-world experience.
And I want to point out that I think the question is where we disagree. I'm a believer in markets for some kinds of commodities, but I don't know that a market works in healthcare. I mean, LASIK surgery.
Let's all agree that markets don't work in healthcare.
Right, but LASIK surgery possibly, I would say, works because it's discretionary, which makes a big difference. A lot of healthcare isn't discretionary. So, you know, if I'm lying there being told I need an appendectomy on a stretcher in one of those hospital gowns, I'm not in a good position to shop around or to bargain, right? I'm not sure that market conditions really exist in healthcare. Another example that I bring up is, okay, say a hospital has taken over the market for cancer care in a part of Florida, which has happened. If you're a markets person, you'll say, and if you're the FTC, you say, oh, well, another provider could move in. The prices are high there because that provider has a monopoly, so someone else will move in. Well, that's a great idea, but it's going to take a few years before someone goes, I'm going to move my practice to Florida. What happens to the cancer patients in that period?
Can I ask you, as a citizen, I want to know how Medicare or Medicaid decides which bills they will pay. Private citizens, if they get an outrageous bill, are stuck with it one fashion or another. But if Medicare pays it, they're costing the whole game credibility as well as money.
Right.
How does that work out? Does Medicare say, no, you're going to the $25 blood test on the street, not the $1,000 one inside the Cathedral Hospital?
No, Medicare says what it will pay for each service with some variation nationally for geography.
Right.
And that has worked pretty well, actually. But some providers say, I'm not going to do it for that amount. But there are an increasing number of doctors who say that Medicare is actually one of their better payers. They are happy with Medicare rates.
Right.
So there's a lot of dissent within the medical community whether Medicare is a decent rate or too low a rate. Now, you know, I think the problem is that, you know, Medicare does work pretty well. It's controlled costs better than other parts of our system, certainly. And I think it is a big threat and was a big threat when Hillary Clinton suggested, probably pushed by the Sanders campaign, that we're just going to start lowering the Medicare age. You know, that is a way you get to single payer.
I want to ask Jonathan Bush. Yeah. You built your business originally around billing services for doctors and small groups of doctors.
Started as a birth center, actually, but couldn't get paid. Athena Women's Health, maternity care, and the doctors blocked because we used midwives, which were less expensive and delivered better outcomes at half the cost outside of a hospital. We got blocked.
I wanted to ask you, though, about Libby's rule number 9 out of the 10 rules of a dysfunctional medical market. Number 9 says, there are no standards for billing. There is money to be made in billing for anything and everything. True or not?
There are very strict standards for billing, and there's tons of money to be made by billing. And the big problem with Medicare that no one mentions, they're a price fixer. But they don't look at, review for sanity, anything. They pay everything. That's why they're such an efficient payer. And that's why it costs almost $1,000 a month for every single Medicare beneficiary, except Medicare Advantage beneficiaries, where the doctor can shop on behalf of a Medicare patient. And those are 30% cheaper with higher satisfaction.
I wish someone other than, anti-healthcare... dare I say, Republicans would talk about those prices. Coming up, jingles and slogans in the wonder world of healthcare, or what you can learn just by looking at the unchanging layout of your drugstore. Nancy Toms is a scholar who makes the modern history of healthcare graphic and almost funny. Look around your very own CVS or Walgreens, she was telling us this week, at the mix of hair colors and painkillers, high science, low commerce, cough drops, and coffin nails, breath mints, and condoms, candy, and the big profit center now, medical prescriptions.
Americans have a long tradition of self-medicating. I don't want to pay to go to the doctor. I'd rather go to the drugstore and do it myself. Drugstores are among the first stores that Americans visit in cities, sometimes daily, certainly weekly. They offer not just health-related goods, but also things like candy and cigarettes. Talk about a split mentality. But the other piece that makes the drugstore so complicated is what is located always in the back of the store. I guarantee you, you cannot find a drugstore in this country where the prescription counter is not at the back of the store. It's a very old tradition. The premise is you're going to set it up in a way that on the way back to pick up the powerful drug, the drug that you can only get with your doctor's permission from the white-coated pharmacist, you're going to walk by all these other enticing aisles.
Maybe the whole story is right there in that layout.
Alice in Wonderland, that was one of the images that the early consumerist critics used when they talked about the drugstore and the wares there, that it really was this fun house of distorted mirrors.
Meet the overnight wonder.
It's tiny.
It's all you need. You see, X-Lax pills gently stimulate your system's own natural rhythm.
So in the morning,
your own system takes it from there, comfortably.
The kinds of promises that an ad could make, whether it was an ad for makeup or for constipation reliever. Take me and I will transform your life. You asked about where the shopper mentality comes from. It originates in people having to listen to all this advertising and learn to take it with a big grain of salt. So you become kind of experienced in knowing that plop, plop, fizz, fizz is, that's an ad.
Alka-Seltzer, plop, plop, fizz, fizz. Oh, what a relief it is.
Of course they're going to say that. And yes, Speedy is kind of cute, but the prudent consumer is one who doesn't believe everything she hears in an advertisement. Mm. So there's this kind of skepticism that you're taught to develop.
And then the ad things get pretty blatant, like ask your doctor, meaning tell your doctor you want something for your love life, Cialis or a sleeping pill or a mood pill. How did that get allowed?
in the early 1980s, pharmaceutical companies really wanted to start advertising prescription drugs directly to patients. There had never been a law against that, but it was kind of gentle person's agreement between pharmaceutical companies and the medical profession, because doctors did not want direct-to-consumer advertising of prescription drugs. So what you start to get is direct-to-consumer advertising, but it's not called advertising, it's called information. So did you know when you see that ad for Cialis that that is information? It's not advertising.
You make a great team. It's been that way since the day you met. But your erectile dysfunction, it could be a question of blood flow. Cialis Tadalafil for daily use helps you be ready anytime the moment's right.
What I think the danger of our American way of thinking is, if you've got a problem, go buy a product or go buy a service and solve it. The idea that you might fix a problem by not buying something seems to really go against our grain. So again, we're back to why you have to shop, why Chris and Nancy have to be so careful, because we have all these people out there trying to sell us something. It really bleeds over into then what your expectations are of care in general.
We've got a sale on lawnmowers this week, Nancy, on your way out. If you...
Oh, golly. What a world. What a world.
You know, we wouldn't have invented a disease unless we had something to take for it. Alka-Seltzer. If Alka-Seltzer can take care of real big upsets, think of what it can do for a simple case of the blues.
Nancy Thompson's big book on this subject is Remaking the American Patient, about how we were taught to be shoppers for health in a medical marketplace. She teaches at Stony Brook University in New York. Adam Gaffney, I mean, shoppers in markets, what does it do for you?
I think it's something that doesn't work in healthcare. You know, and we talked about this a little bit. People don't want to shop, I don't think. And I think when it comes to drugs, there really is no market.
Let's talk about drugs. The fact that, you know, we pay double Canadian prices, which we could import. And the one that I still don't understand, why Medicare in a market system, Jonathan, is barred by law from bargaining with drug companies for obviously massive big purchases. What's the problem? Starting with you, Adam, again.
Well, I mean, the direct answer is that the 2003 Medicare Modernization Act, which was signed by President Bush, bipartisan legislation, made it illegal for Medicare to bargain with health and with drug companies for prices. That we need to undo. You fix that, you can lower drug prices maybe by about half, as you mentioned. I'd like to see that happen nationwide. Bring down drug prices across the country for everybody. Probably brand name drugs would come down by 50%. One estimate puts the savings of doing that at about $110 billion per year, which is not chump change. So yes, let's bring down prices for drugs, and we know how to do it. Other countries do it. It's called bargaining with the drug companies on a nationwide level.
I mean, markets are not just transparency. Then let's get down to this, what are we going to pay here, Nancy? I can't imagine what the politicians said or thought they were doing. I mean, I said, Nancy, forgive me, Libby.
In not allowing bargaining?
Yeah.
They thought they were getting the agreement of pharma for the Affordable Care Act and for other health care legislation, I think, is the real answer. You know, bargaining is, as you said, it's used by every other country very effectively. The narrative is, we need to charge these prices in the U.S. because it supports research and development, and these other countries are really stingy with us. As an American, I say, well, fine, you know, charge them a little bit more. That's, you know, we should share this cost. But also, I think we see over and over again that a lot of, as with the CRISPR technology, a lot of what we're paying for is actually underwritten by federal funding. So why aren't we getting part of the benefit?
Jonathan, how would you, bargain on big purchases, which...
Yeah, I mean, there's radical agreement. It's ridiculous that you can't bargain, that someone can just make up prices and stick them to you, even when you have enormous buying power. That's ridiculous. There is further opportunity for market, which is that most of the drugs are ridiculous and not necessary. Most of the branded drugs you don't need, you can replace with generics or at least start with that. Yeah. So shopping needs to happen not just at the level of price of these things. So Medicare is a price fixer. They set the price. Medicaid is a price fixer. They still have outrageously high prices because nobody's picking and choosing aggressively about which is needed and which is not. That's another layer of this that could make this make it go further. But of course, we don't just lie back and take.
Why don't we? Did you ever ask Cousin George?
I believe it was related to Medicare Part A, with the addition of a drug benefit to Medicare. I think that was, mm-hmm. you know, the drug companies. There's a thing called Medicare Supplemental, which is a buy-up, and drug companies made a lot of money for the people who bought up on Medicare. And George wanted to make it possible for all. Medicare beneficiaries to have some drug coverage. But to do that, the pharma was going to lose a lot of pricing power, and I guess they just caved. I don't know. I wasn't there. But anyway, it was related to Medicare Part A, which allows Medicare beneficiaries to have drugs. That's why that caved.
The legend is out there, Jonathan, that Cousin George looked at you and the writer said, they made you a CEO?
He did. He did. He said, wait a minute, you're the CEO of Athena. He said, you know, electronic medical records could be a game changer. And he reached into his upper right drawer and pulled out a spreadsheet on the cost impact of literally randomly and showed me what he and his treasury secretary have been going through on the re-performing of tests and diagnostics amongst government-funded, you know, mostly Medicare beneficiaries. He blew me away. It was the most impressive George W. moment of my entire natural life, starting when I gave him my first Monkees album when I was about 12.
But you were said to have said, hey, if you can be president of the United States, I can be CEO, right?
I may have said that. That part I don't remember.
I think you said
I doubt he's listening to BUR, but in case.
Matt Brunig is a policy warrior that we follow on Twitter, an embattled progressive, and a sort of proof when we spoke this week that even wonks, very smart wonks, have no idea what they're choosing in the maze of medical care these days.
It's very complicated, and it's almost worse when you have choices even. At my last job, it was a very, very big employer, and we had literally 19 health plans that we could choose from, each with their own 75-page document about what they covered. It's absurd. Like, anyone could go through what would have been 1,400 pages of materials to try to figure out, yeah, this is the health insurance for me. It's just ridiculous. So naturally, you're just like, just pick one. But then you don't really even know what's covered. So when my wife got pregnant, she was 24 years old or 25. It was right about that age where you are still able to be on your parents' insurance. And she was still on her parents' insurance. But by rule, dependent care, which is what she would have been on, doesn't have to cover pregnancies. And so we find ourselves in this situation, and we're going to the gynecologist, and it's like, no, insurance doesn't cover this. And it's like, well, you know, who knows? Who checks any of that to know whether that's the case or not? It's just an enormous hassle. It would be easier if it were just like automatic, standardized, get your Medicare card, and you have a good sense that, you know, whatever it is, it's going to get covered. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the people who are uninsured, it's young adults. And I'm sure many of them are making that calculation. Why pay any premium? I rarely go to the doctor. I'm pretty healthy. It's better just to hold out, self-pay in the case that maybe I need it, and, you know, roll the dice, rather than buy one of these insurance products that, in addition to paying premiums, you mostly can't use anyway, because the deductibles, the out-of-pocket expenses that you have to pay in order to even trigger reimbursement from the insurer is so high. I think that's definitely a calculation people make when they're younger, and you see it in the uninsured rates.
You're a young guy with a young constituency online, Matt. How does your generation see its way to not a particular program, but to a healthy country for everybody?
Increased communications have made it a lot easier for people to realize things are different in other countries. That would not have been the case even 20 30 years ago. But online, it's very easy. You can go into all sorts of websites and see, you know, hey, in Sweden, you get 480 days off when you have a kid. That seems really pleasant. Why can't we do that? So there seems to have been an expanding of horizons among a certain kind of politically engaged youngster. The younger generation has dealt with the biggest economic crisis since the Great Depression. And they've seen, you know, much higher student debt, much worse job prospects, higher unemployment for a long period of time. One way or another, there seems to be a growing realization that, you know, things are not going that well. And the idea that you as an individual are going to be able to bootstrap your way to a good life is not likely. So that opens you up more, I think, to collective solutions, to collective problems.
Jonathan Bush, back in Matt Bruning's maze there, how do you figure out options or tell people how to do it?
One of the things that we, by structuring and requiring all these codes as the only way to get paid, we've killed the notion of product management, right? We have marketing, but no product management. No one says, look, if you have this, we got it. You don't need to know the fine print of this and that. Every other sector has product management where they refine and guarantee and essentially self-insure their product. If you don't like your L.L. Bean boot, bring it back and we'll give you another. You don't have the same thing other than some new efforts from the government to do the same thing. I think that doctors need to be the first shoppers, personal shoppers, to help people. When you're sick and you're talking about complicated things with elaborate codes, you don't know. You really do need, and the doctors that have taken this on and taken risk for their customers' costs, for their patients' costs, have had enormous impact on not just the cost of the patient's care, but the personal power, the satisfaction, the comfort, the stress level of the care, because they're acting as a personal advisor. And that's what I think is the sort of first baby step to a working market, which we don't have today.
My question, what time we have left, is why not Medicare for all? Private medicine, but public insurance with the benefit of price lists, universal access, no insurance company division of the marketplace and all that advertising for this group or that. Why not? Jonathan Bush, we'll go in order.
I think we can do better. I'm excited about a kind of care that no one else has. So let's be like Sweden. Let's be like Switzerland. No, let's be like America at its best, not America in this crippled manifestation. And I think that's something.
And what would it be? I mean, how would it be different from Medicare?
I think Medicare overpays in terms of utilization, not in terms of price fixing. They have fixed prices, but then they massively overtest people. You can't believe what we do to people in the last years of their lives. It's toxic. And that wouldn't happen if we had Medicare Advantage. We have Medicare Advantage. We could be doing that today.
Remind me, what's the advantage?
Medicare Advantage is a plan where you can enroll your trust in a payer or a doctor, almost like HMO coverage, and then they shop for you. You don't just get whatever you walk up for. And I think that the guys who do that well, there's a few of them, not a lot, but there's more of them being born every day, are creating a whole different experience of care and a whole different experience of being a doctor.
Adam Gavney, why not Medicare for all?
Why not indeed? Let me say, the main problem with a market in healthcare is that when you have a market, ultimately you get what you can afford, which means the rich get the highest level of care and the poor get the worst. And that is fundamentally inequitable and no one wants it. So a Medicare for all system could save around $600 billion a year by one estimate. It could cover everybody. It could make healthcare a right, which is what people want. And let me say, it's a political winner. The Gallup poll performed last year found 58% support for a federally funded healthcare program. What are we waiting for? The people want that. People want this. And they want it for a reason, because they want to be taken care of and they want their loved ones to be taken care of. And they don't want to have to worry about price or how it will affect their life, their livelihood. So let's move on to it. Absolutely. There's no good reasons not to.
Libby Rosenthal, 30 seconds. Why not Medicare for all?
It's certainly one option and one that would work. But Americans have contradictory impulses with healthcare. They say they want to be covered. They also say they want choice. So those are two contradictory things often. You don't get endless choice in a Medicare for all system. But then again, when you say, well, how did you make the choice for that orthopedic surgeon? They'll say, oh, because my neighbor liked him and he was a really nice guy, which is not real choice anyway. We don't have the data to make good choices.
Thank you all. Elizabeth Rosenthal, Jonathan Bush, and Adam Gaffney. Thanks also to John Gruber, Matt Brunig, and Nancy Toms. Do visit our website for more conversation, podcasts, and Zach Goldhammer's terrific video about drugstores as the image of everything we talked about this hour. Subscribe to us on iTunes and help support our team with whatever you want to send. Our website is radioopensource.org. Our show this week was produced by that same guy, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, Becca DiGregorio, and Susan Coyne. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.